Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Alaska presents some unique challenges to a writer. While we get to talk about one of the world's biggest, grandest places and the adventures that happened here, there's also the constant hazard of slipping into cliches or just falling short of the landscape. Books about Alaska can be overwhelmed by Alaska. On today's show, I'm talking to writers who took on this challenge successfully. In the first half, a book about a couple who came to the state in the 1960s and explored some of its wildest places before becoming involved in the movement to protect much of Alaska as national parks and refuges. Ray Bain and the author who worked with him, Kayleen Johnson Sullivan, are with me. In the second half, my guest is Debbie Clark Motoro, whose new book, Fast Into the Night, is coming out just in time for the Iditarod. Debbie writes about her life with dogs and her struggle to finish the race. I hope to learn from all my guests about their amazing stories and the challenges of capturing that life on the page. And with me now in the studio, I have Kayleen Johnson Sullivan, who is an author, and Ray Bain, who is a very distinguished outdoors person and has had a big impact on Alaska in terms of where we have public lands and where lands are protected. And Ray is joining us from Maui. They've recently published a book, Our Perfect Wild, Ray and Barbara Bain's Journeys and the Fate of the Far North, by Kayleen Johnson Sullivan with Ray Bain. Thanks for being with us, Ray.
Thank you, Charles. I look forward to it.
And Kayleen, thanks for being in the studio.
Thank you.
So you've written a lot of books, Kayleen, and you've written with other notable people, and I've had you on the show before. How did this particular topic come to you, and what interested you about Ray Bain's story?
Well, Ray Bain actually contacted me, and he had read a previous biography about Dick Griffith, who's an outdoor adventurer, and he contacted me, and I agreed to read his journals, and when I did, I was just really taken by the story of him and Barbara's journeys in the far north. They did some remarkable things, and it was a love story on many levels and an adventure story on many levels, and a story about two very brave people.
So they came to Alaska in the early 1960s, really dove into the culture of rural Alaska, toured and traveled by dog sled, and then had a really key part in the Anilka land legislation, which set so many of our national parks and national wildlife refuges.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Ray might speak better to this, but they came up as school teachers in the early 1960s and completely were absorbed and by the native way of life and loved the sensibilities of the native culture. And through that, and through a long dog team trip in 1974, they were approached by the National Park Service to help with these Anilka lands.
The book tells that story, and it was also nicely illustrated, a lot of great pictures in it, and just came out from the University of Alaska Press.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, Ray, tell me about the beginning of your story, coming to Alaska. Everybody's got a coming to Alaska story.
Well, ours probably isn't all that different from a lot of folks. I was oriented to outdoor living or outdoor life as a young kid. My father was an active hunter and fisherman, and I followed him around, went camping, joined in his activities, and so, you know, as time went on, I became pretty comfortable being out in at least in the West Virginia version of the wilds. When my wife and I, or when my wife-to-be and I decided that we were going to get married, we had planned to live in Cleveland, Ohio. That was going to be our base. Barbara had relatives there, and we both enjoyed. And then one day, just before our wedding, we happened to go to a movie, and it was titled White Wilderness. and it was a Disney film, a wildlife film. We were captivated by it. And from that point on, I became kind of fixated on the idea of going to Alaska, spending upwards of 1 year, and then just sort of an experience, and having that to be something we could talk about as, you know, as we aged.
What a funny way to begin the story. I'm sure it wasn't a great piece of art, the Disney film. Have you ever gone back and looked at it?
You know, I've been trying to find it, and I've seen references to it, but I have never been able to bring up a copy of it.
So you came to Alaska, you were a teacher, I guess, in Sitka, and then you ended up going out to Wainwright and really diving into the depth of it.
To Point Barrow.
Oh, Point Barrow, uh-huh.
All right, and we spent a year in Barrow, became involved in some of the activities of the people there, and they were just terrific folks. I got to go out hunting with some of the men, got involved in a little bit in whaling, and then in the spring I took a dog team trip, or I hooked up a bunch of dogs, and that I can loosely refer to them as a team. They weren't all that well trained. But anyhow, I went down to the village of Wainwright. I thought this is about as good as it's going to get in terms of living in a semi-wild area. And with the following fall, we moved there and became school teachers.
And so this was early 1960s, and right. really things were still pretty traditional in those days.
Very much so. It was a really exciting time to be there. Exciting and hectic in some ways, because so much change was taking place. And we got there before the advent of the snow machine, or at least before it became a major way of getting around. So people were still using dog teams and still traveling in skin-covered boats. They were still pretty much following the old ways. And a lot of their traditions, a lot of their social culture was wrapped around that. So it was a pretty special time to be there.
And it sounds like you really kind of adopted that culture and became completely fascinated by it.
Yes, we did. To the degree we could. I wish I were better at linguistics, you know, being able to learn new languages. But I tried my best to become as conversant in the Inupiat language as I could. And when we were teaching, we made it a practice to bring elders, especially the village elders, into the classroom and have them participate and use them as resources, telling their stories, showing how they made their living off the land, and then incorporating that in our classwork.
Hmm. Kayleen, your job was to kind of take Ray and Barbara Bain's story and put it on the page. And he's obviously a good storyteller, but still that's kind of a challenge when you weren't there, right? How do you sort of bring that to life as a third person who wasn't present?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question, because Ray is articulate and he's a very good writer of it on his own. And there were 800 pages of single-space journals to read through. Mm. The hard part really was what to leave out, and then to figure out how to tell the story. And we just decided that because Ray had such beautiful passages of writing of his own, that we would use excerpts from his journals and then use my work and words to move the story forward and put it into the shape and form of a book, because mm-hmm. 800 pages in a journal just wasn't going to work, you know?
Yeah.
So,
did you have to sit down at some point and say, well, here's the story, this is the story we want to tell, and then all this other great material we're just going to set aside?
Well, you know, we did, and that really is the hard, really hard process. For me, that's the hardest part, and probably for Ray as well. Which part do we include, and what part do we have to leave out just by necessity?
Mm-hmm. So, Ray, tell me about that. How did you choose Kayleen, and how did that working relationship go?
Well, first off, let me, if I may, just make a couple of comments on what you've already said. This would not be a book were it not for Kayleen. As Kayleen has said, we had a lot of material, a lot of notes and journals, logs that we've been keeping for years. And to get that organized and to condense it down into a readable form was a tremendous undertaking. And it, as I say, had it not been for Kayleen, yeah, I don't think it would have taken place. But in terms of us getting together, we share friends, and they are Steve and Janice Tower. Kayleen had written a book earlier about an individual that Dick Griffith, that the Towers know very well, and they had the Janice and Steve, who are very close friends of ours. Matter of fact, we are taking care of their property here on Maui. They had been after us for a long time to turn our tall tales into an actual book. Kept putting it off, and finally they refused to take any more excuses, and they made arrangements for Kayleen and I to get together, and that's pretty much how it everything came together.
It's such an important thing to do, to take your memories and put them down on paper before you get too old, you know, because you've got to, this is history, and it's very, very important, and it will become more important as time passes. And if nobody sort of records it, then it will, you know, it won't be around. So that's a great thing that you guys have done.
Thank you. But, you know, again, it's Kayleen's work as much as mine, and perhaps even more. But what you just said to me has been a, an impetus to our work in Alaska. We had the opportunity to become acquainted with some amazing elders, Native elders, that had lived virtually, you know, had just stepped out of the pre-European contact and into what is now the modern world. And they still carried so much of the wisdom and the traditions and the richness of the Native culture with them that was only, you know, modestly changed. And they wanted to share that. They wanted people to become more aware of those, you know, of those that of that life, of the Native perspective. And so we just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and we got a chance to spend our time with some of the most wonderful storytellers that you could possibly imagine. And it was through them that we learned so much, and that I think had a pretty major impact on our outlook on life.
Yeah, wonderful experience. I'm envious of you. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and we're talking today about some new books on Alaska and on the outdoors. And right now, Our Perfect Wild, Ray and Barbara Bain's Journeys in the Fate of the Far North by Kayleen Johnson Sullivan with Ray Bain. And Kayleen and Ray are both with me right now. So you decided to take this long trek. You and Barbara decided to take this long trek by dog sled. And that, again, changed your life because you got involved in conservation and in protecting Alaskan lands. In the mid-1970s, Alaska was in the midst of this huge controversy over which lands would be conserved or protected long-term and which could be used for development, which became in 1980 the Alaska National Interest Lands Act. And Ray, somehow you turned this dog mushing journey into having a role in determining those, making those decisions, and that's an extraordinary story in itself.
It was just a wonderful time to be there. Time to, you know, the things that were going on were going to have enormous impact on the future of Alaska, and just by happenstance, we happened to be in the right place at the right time, and we were involved in, at that particular point, in preparing for this long dog team trip. It turned out to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 miles across northern Alaska. It was a dream that we had had for years. And we decided before we got too old, we wanted to be able to do it and to feel confident and comfortable in the process. And we took that trip. And along the way, had it not been for the people that took care of us, that looked out for us, we pulled into villages and folks would come out and they would take our dogs to their homes and to care for them, and they put us up and feed us. And then they would let the folks know in the next village that we were on our way. And so it was a trip of hospitality the whole route. There were a few bumps along the way, but overall, it was because of that that welcoming that we were able to do that trip, and it helped to form our outlook again, change it, and make it more focused on trying to preserve a land, its character, and trying to find ways to accommodate a cultural blanket of cultural interests and the way of life that had been going on for countless generations.
Yeah.
See if we could figure out ways to help make those two mesh.
So how did you get from school teacher to land protector? How did that unusual connection take place?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it started in with wolves, first off. If you recall, back in the 1960s, there was a big controversy about aerial wolf hunting and about the efforts to, quote, manage, end quote, wolves by culling them and by turning that process over to private pilots. We got involved in that. We happened to be, trying to, not allow the aerial gunning of wolves, but rather we had no problem with the local people hunting them, in their traditional ways, trapping them. But we felt that new way, that new technology, the use of aircraft, really was a wasn't in keeping with the ideals of wildlife management that I felt should reflect the character of Alaska. So we got involved, and from that beginning, we were brought into the process of forming a new conservation organization in Fairbanks. And then from there, one thing would lead to another. And over time, we became very heavily enmeshed in conservation issues.
Mm-hmm. So, and the map was sort of being drawn in those days to determine all the national parks and refuges that we're sort of familiar with now. Is that something you got involved with as well?
Yes. After the dog team trip, we were asked to study the use of the land and its resources by particularly by Native people in their subsistence activities. And so we spent 2 years living with and documenting the subsistence activities of the Kuvangmiit, the Kobuk River Eskimo people, and the Koyukon, the Athabascan people of the Koyukuk River. And then we extended that up into the Central Brooks Range to Anaktuvuk Pass. So we spent 2 years documenting those activities and that way of life, and trying to figure out ways that it could be incorporated in new national parks that were being proposed. At the end of those 2 years, I was hired to become an assistant to a gentleman by the name of John Kaufman, who's recently passed. And John was the primary planner National Park Service planner for what became Gates of the Arctic National Park. And my job under John was to go out and explore.
Oh, neat.
That was what I did for a living.
That's a great job. So
it was amazing.
So behind a dog team?
If they had not paid me, I think I would have paid them.
So were you just exploring around behind a dog team on a snow machine, that kind of thing, in an airplane?
Not so much on snow machines. I did travel by dog team. And I had, by this time, I was a pilot, and I had access to my own aircraft. I had a Citabria at the time. And then the Park Service provided me with a Super Cub to work with, along with the 185 liter. And so I traveled by dog team. I floated, in canoes, and I flew around the countryside and did lots and lots of hiking.
Wow, what a dream. That sounds amazing.
Yes.
So, Kayleen, did you know about any of this before you got started on the project? I mean, was this a lot of new history and stuff for you to encounter when you're talking to Ray?
Well, it was very educational to research this because I'd, heard in passing a lot about ANILCA and the Native Claim Settlement Act. But this put a face and a person to the history of the state, and I think that it's really fascinating. And one of the things I say in the book is that in a land of ice and snow, Ray and Barbara stepped into the fire because mm-hmm. there was so much controversy about those public lands at the time. And I feel like we owe them a huge thank you for being willing to stand up for public lands for all of us.
Yeah, I remember also that there was a fairly broad negative stereotype that was created that people who were environmentalists or people who were for protecting lands were all these East Coast, elite people.
And Ray and Barbara were out there living the lifestyle. They were hunting and trapping and doing the kinds of things that everybody was doing on the land. They were part of the equation. Uh-huh. They weren't outsiders. They were more a part of the land than probably any of us could imagine.
Yeah, really. So were there any particular stories that illustrated that for you particularly well of dealing with this conflict?
Well, there's a scene in the book that, just makes me amazed. After President Carter used the Antiquities Act to create monuments in Alaska, the state just erupted. It was not mm-hmm. thought that that would happen. And when it did, it was just a huge source of controversy and misinformation. And at the time, Ray was working in Bettles, and he was on vacation when this was happening, when the Antiquities Act was was used by President Carter. And when he got back to Bettles, the National Park Service said, you know what? We don't think it's even safe for you to go back right now. There's been threats against Park Service employees. We think you maybe ought to stay in town. And it was, for Ray and Barbara, it was no way. This is where we live. And we want to tell people and our friends what's happening. So there's this scene in the book where he is walking into a community meeting with people hissing and booing and standing up and saying terrible things. And these were people that had been his friends and neighbors. And he just stood up and just explained what was happening and why, and how it wasn't going to change things as much as they expected. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was so brave. That was so brave for him and Barbara to go back and face that angry crowd.
Right. And for those who don't know their history so well, legislation had been pending and the discussion had been going on for almost a decade over this land conservation. President Carter saw his term, the end of his term nearing, and so he just used his power to, just on his own, with this wave of a pen, to protect lands as national monuments, which then the bill passed, and those, they were protected as national parks and refuges and so forth. So, Ray, tell me about dealing with that. That must have been really difficult, and I wonder if you were able to convince people that. This was for the best. I think most people accept these days that it probably was.
At the time, it was obviously very intense. there were people, many people, particularly in rural areas, who had sincere concerns and had every reason to be concerned. They didn't have enough information about what had happened and how it was going to impact their lives. And they were, you know, their feelings were very sincere, and they should be, they had to be respected. The fact that, you know, some of that directed some of the anger and frustration toward us was just part of my job. My job, as I saw it, was to explain what had taken place. We tried ahead of time. We tried to talk to our neighbors and to the local residents and let them know what was likely to take place. I had gone back to Washington, D.C. to work with a team of individuals in drawing up a environmental impact statement in support of President Carter's action. So I had some fairly detailed insight into what we could expect. And as I say, I tried to bring that back with me and to tell people what was going to likely take place. In most cases, the local folks just said, "Ah, you know, it's not going to happen. You know,
I didn't believe you.
Whole process is going to burn out now, and that we're going to go back to pretty much what we've always had." And I tried to say, I don't think so. I'm almost certain that we're going to have some presidential action to hold those lands.
Did you ever fear for your safety, as Kayleen was saying? Did you ever feel like you were in danger?
Only on a couple of occasions, and maybe there were more. But on one occasion in particular, the plane that I was using, was deliberately sabotaged.
Wow.
On another occasion, I had someone approach me who had been with a group of individuals in the local Bettles Lodge, came out and told me, he said, "Do you know what they're talking about in there?" And I'd passed some fellows that were sitting around the table when I'd been in the lodge and walked out. And I said, "No, I have no idea." And he said, they're talking about how they could kill you and get away with it.
Wow.
That's kind of unsettling.
I could think so, yeah.
So, and it wasn't the people who were doing the talking that worried me. It was the people who were just sitting there quietly listening.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the folks that are more likely to cause you problems.
What an adventure story. What a great life in the North, and so many accomplishments as an outdoors person and also as just a citizen protecting and working for Alaska. Ray Bain, the book is called Our Perfect Wild, Ray and Barbara Bain's Journeys in the Fate of the North by Kayleen Johnson Sullivan with Ray Bain. Publisher is Snowy Owl Books, which is part of University of Alaska Press. It's available now. I want to thank both of you very much for being with me today. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, Charles.
And enjoy sunny Hawaii. Thanks for being with me again, Kayleen.
Thank you, Charles.
Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is writing about Alaska, books about our adventures and our outdoors, and I'm excited to have my next guest here talk about her very first book. Debbie Clark Motoro ran the Iditarod twice. First time, rookie, didn't make it. Quite an adventure. And then she had to come back and try again, and she made it. And as we get ready for the Iditarod to start, it's a great topic, and another exciting book about the Iditarod. Fast into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. Thanks for being with me, Debbie.
Thank you, Charles. It's great to be here.
So tell me how you got into dog mushing in the first place. What was the magic that caught your feelings when you were first doing it?
Well, the magic that caught my feelings was quite unexpected. Mark and I lived up on the hillside. I had just suffered a series of mid-pregnancy miscarriages, and Bernie Willis, an Iditarod veteran, called me one night, said he and his wife Jeanette were coming to our house. They had a present for me. And I said, "Leave me alone. I'm down in the dumps." And he said, "Nope, we're coming and we're bringing a dog." So his retired 7-year-old Iditarod husky named Salt walked into our door, and it wasn't more than a matter of a few days before he captured all of our hearts.
Uh-huh.
And he definitely pulled me out of my doldrums.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of your experience with mushing sounds like it's about your relationship with the animals rather than sort of what we think of as the bold adventure across Alaska. It was sort of you grew into this through just loving dogs.
I grew into it through loving the land here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. I was a climber and a skier. But we fell in love with the sport through raising our young kids. They were 5 and 6 when we got Salt. Before I knew it, we had 2 puppies in the backyard as well for Salt to mentor, and he was mentoring us as well. And the kids wanted to go in the junior ASDRA races. And so there was that first day when Hannah went in the 1-dog class and Andy went in the 2.
Uh-huh.
And they came in all smiles. I don't think they came in very quickly, and I was quite worried about the dogs and the children. But one thing led to another. We needed more and more dogs to support the junior fun, and made great friends, camped for spring break at the Nancy Lake Canoe Trails. And by the time they went to college, they were leaving 22 huskies in our backyard, and both Andy and Hannah had run 4 junior Iditarods at that point.
Wow. So, I mean, some families get caught up in hockey, some get caught up in skiing. You got caught up in maybe the most challenging and expensive sport you possibly could, maybe other than yachting, I don't know. But, I mean, it really takes over your whole lifestyle, doesn't it?
It took over our lives, but it really happened to us. We fell in love with one dog, and before you know it, all 4 of us were just enthralled with all of it. And for many years, the kids were the leading edge of our mushing adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Andy did Iditarod before any of the rest of us even thought about it. So,
yeah. What was your, how did you come about your decision to do the race or to try the race?
Well, Andy worked as Martin Boozer's handler the year between high school and college. And he had a wonderful, hard year there. There was no snow that winter, lots of difficult training, but his run on Iditarod was a real joy. He did very, very well, and under the finish line, he said, "Mom, you have to do this." And I really hadn't considered it before. I had been in some 200-mile races myself. Of course, I'd been in the sport for 12 years by then. I never would have taken it on when the kids were at home. I was too much of a mom.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved these dogs. The empty nest did not look very good to me. And I thought, all right, I'm on. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've talked to lots of Iditarod rookies and sort of, you might say, dilettantes who want to do it and want to say it's something they did. You know, the way sort of somebody might climb Denali and they hire a guide and climb it. But most people don't do it with their own dog team who are sort of, unless that's their, you know, they live out in Willow and they're totally a lifestyle. You're here from Anchorage living on the hillside and you did it with your own dog team.
Right, we did. And we work only on positive reinforcement, and the dogs live a pretty cushy kennel life with us. They all come in for a while, go back out. And in those days, many of them had mastered junior racing, which is a whole other ballgame. And even junior Iditarod is very short, obviously, mm-hmm. compared to Iditarod. So when I look back at that first team, we had some very sweet dogs. They were athletic. They were well-trained. But the dogs and I were rookies in the long haul. There's no question about that.
So tell me about the differences between the junior sport and the big time.
The junior Iditarod and the big time? Well, first of all, the junior sport itself mm-hmm. is sprint racing, which sadly, because of the climate,
disappearing.
is disappearing, which makes me very fearful for the future of the sport, because if the kids in our urban areas can't get going through a junior club, and why would you keep five dogs if there hasn't been a junior racing season for 3 years? You know, that's tough.
Yeah.
But those junior races were golden. Actually, they work just the way the one-doggers go out in the woods for a mile, mile and a half. You wait at the finish line looking down that trail. Sometimes the dog comes in without the child.
My baby has been pulled off into the woods by a dog.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's sounds of people chattering about moose and other things. Uh-huh. And you think, whoa. Then they go in junior Iditarod when they're 14, and that's...
What's the distance in that?
It varied year to year. I don't know exactly what it is now. Mm-hmm. Usually when they did it, it was probably between 120 and 180 miles. They have a camp out in the middle. You're not allowed indoors at Yentna Station.
Mm-hmm.
Great fun, stories of bonfires, very, very happy kids coming in, having gone a very significant distance with 10 dogs each. Mark and I and the kids, the kids who are in their 30s, still talk about that being the best race in the sport.
What an amazing experience for a kid to have and to take forward in life as a college student or whatever.
Right. It defined their years. They'll both say that now.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. Great to put on your college applications, too.
So funny. People said, you're so smart to put your kids into dog mushing. I'm like, do you think we did it for that purpose?
Yeah, really. So you decided to run the Iditarod, and you had essentially sprint-trained dogs.
Right.
And also, I mean, those who really want to win the race don't cozy up to their dogs that much, right? I mean, they're thinking about, you know, paring down the team and getting just the absolute best and getting rid of the dogs that aren't the absolute best. Sounds like maybe you were a little bit warmer-hearted about the whole thing.
Well, in defense of my peers, you know, go to Sebastian's website and look at all 20 dogs of his on the couch and around his feet in his living room. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of intimacy that everybody shares with their dogs one way or the other. That said, I am incapable of... looking at a dog team in terms of selling dogs to improve our group. Our purpose from day one, probably because of my soft heart, is to maximize what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
And not to, yes, we've of course added dogs, and we do place dogs as pets when they retire.
Mm-hmm.
But our focus is to bring out the best in each individual. And we have never had a big kennel. It was somewhat problematic to live in Anchorage. So when we started Iditarod, we also started training more and more in Willow. And eventually we set up a kennel in Denali Park.
Hmm.
So to this day, we split our time between Anchorage and Denali. We have a handler that lives up there full time with the dogs.
Wow, that's
and Mark
a lot
and
of driving.
I go back and forth. Well, when you're a rider, I can go 10 days on, 3 days off. You know, I can do whatever I want.
I'm talking to Debbie Clark Motor on today's Outdoor Explorer. Our topic is writing about the outdoors, and Debbie's new book, Fast Into the Night, is about her experience in the Iditarod with I don't know if you'd call it failure, but setbacks and then success. So tell us about that first race.
Well, the first race started in Fairbanks because there was no snow. Training was very miserable that winter.
And what year was this?
2003. Mm-hmm. And we did pretty darn well all the way to the coast. And when my dogs went out on the sea ice out of Shaktulik, all of a sudden their noses were pointed to the ground, their ears were flat. It was very, very windy that day. None of us had ever been to the coast before. We were 10 days into the race. Robert Sorley had already crossed the finish line. And my dog sat down. And I was stunned. Now, in hindsight, I can see the beginnings of this. Signs of their lack of focus beginning in the, I don't know, 75 miles before. But at the time, I did not know what had hit us. I was pretty shocked. Nothing worse could have happened to me out there, in my mind, than losing a connection with my dogs.
They had just decided they weren't going to run anymore.
They had. And I had never experienced anything like that, and I thought that happened to people that pushed too hard when they were really competing. We had taken our time. All I wanted to do was get happy, healthy dogs to the finish, and all of a sudden my dogs were really balking in front of my eyes, and no matter what I said to them, they were very theatrical and more than a little bit negative.
What do you think? What do you think affected them? What got them into that mood of the giving up and resisting?
In hindsight, I will never know for sure. I do believe there was an alpha dog. Well, I know there was an alpha leader in the team who, for some reason, didn't like the ice, and I had no idea of that. But she's very subtle in all her interactions with the other dogs, and I think she might have tipped everybody off. The other possibility, and it's so basic, is that when I get tired, I begin to doubt myself a little bit. I think they were reading me, and the play out of that was to feed them more. Because when you get to the coast, of course, they've been on the trail for 10 days. They're a little bit thinner. I was worried. Those dogs ate so much in those few checkpoints right before we left Shaktulik. And I now look back and think, gosh, you know, you don't eat a hamburger at mile 22 of a human marathon, you know, and that alone could have pitched them into a metabolic swing, that and a little bit of trail fatigue, you know, then a landscape that they just had never fathomed before. My guess is that it was a combination of
kind of got
factors.
Freaked out. The dogs got freaked out. Yeah. So how did you feel? I mean, that must have been just a really difficult time.
I was devastated. We made it to the shelter cabin outside of Shaktulik, the infamous shelter cabin.
You just drag him?
No. A snow machine went in front of us for a while, and we got that far, but they refused to go any further. Mm-hmm. So I would never, dragging them is not something I probably we would do. In fact, it's not something I would do. I tried to walk in front of them for a while, and that doesn't work very well. So we got there, and we stayed there for almost 36 hours, and I tried everything. Friends of mine that were behind me in the pack went by me, and I called my dogs up, and they called to them, and no go. So
that must be so frustrating to realize that the magic of dog mushing in the first place is this human connection between the dog driver and the dogs, where you know you can just tell them left, right, go by, you know, you have this incredible connection that is like magic, right? And then to have it just disappear must be very weird.
It was absolutely devastating, and there's not much more to say about it. I was just shocked. I felt like a complete loser. Went back to the Shaktulik checkpoint with the help of the trail sweeps, and the head of the checkpoint there came out and said, "Debbie, there's some kids that want to meet you. I'm really sorry, but there's a lot of kids from the village in there. You're their hero." And I said, "You have got to be kidding. There's no way I'm anybody's hero."
Mm-hmm.
So I see that all a little bit differently now. But.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you get over that and decide to come back and try it again?
Well, my husband Mark and I had agreed that he would run the next year. And at that point, I felt, A, like a failure, and B, like the only right thing to do and what I wanted to do was give him a chance. You know, he had supported me so much through that year. And as the musher, I felt like it was a little too much about me that whole year, the money, the effort, everything. I got to know him and threw my arms around him and said, "They're all yours. You're going next year for sure." And he said, "No, you've got to finish what you started." And I'm like, "We'll talk about that later."
When you say you got to know him, what's the practicality of getting a dog team out?
We flew to Nome in an airplane.
Wow.
And that wasn't my favorite moment either.
Right.
A couple of my dogs sat on the seats and looked out the window, and I sat on the floor with the rest of them. There was another musher in the plane too who had scratched and checked it.
All right, so you decided to hand it over to your husband.
I handed it to Mark. He went on Iditarod the next year. He had trouble. I did a lot of the training because he works full-time. He's an attorney for GCI. And the dog started acting up on him in the Copper Basin race and in the Tustamina. And we decided when things got a little scary in that department to pull out the dogs that we thought might have caused my trouble. And we leased some dogs from our great friend Vern Halter, dogs that had seen the end of the trail that might ground ours with a little bit of courage. And Mark had a great run, finished. And when he crossed that finish line, I knew that was my new starting line, because by then I was more than excited about going again.
So you think there are individual dogs who are kind of had a bad attitude, and that might have been the problem?
I do think that's true. Mm-hmm. But it's also, many veterans said to me, Debbie, this is a virus. And if it starts in a landscape, it will often repeat.
Mm.
So be careful. You too might want to put some new blood into that team and retire a few of your leaders. Well, I would hear nothing of that, because the only reason I was doing this was to go on a journey with my dogs that we'd raised and lived with the kids. I mean, it was sort of the family legacy that mm-hmm. propelled me out there to begin with. So I insisted on taking the dogs I took in 2003 again in 2005.
Really? No, that sounds like a crazy decision.
Well, there's a moment or two in the race. Once we got on the sea ice, that I might have agreed with you, because mm-hmm. the trouble did begin again. But we got through it.
So how did you get through it the second time?
You know, I think in that scale of mine that I write about a lot in the book, between daring and doubt, by the time I got out there the second time, I had a lot more confidence that my operation was strong. The dogs ran impeccably. We were right on schedule all the way to Eagle Island, where I got desperately ill. So then they had a double rest. We kept going to Shack Tulik. Yes, I was extremely nervous going by that shelter cabin, going out on the sea ice. That point in the race, I was running with Mel Shirilla, who turned into a treasured, lifelong trail friend of mine. We had helped each other along the way. She and I crossed the sea ice together. No problem. A little hesitation when I waved her by to go ahead of me, but we got there, celebrated. Next morning, woke up. I said, ready to the dogs. They jumped to their feet and started barking, which that late in the race is
good
like
sign.
The best thing that can happen. Bounding over the tundra, down onto the sea ice, couple hundred yards in, they sat down.
Oh, wow. And then what? I mean, your heart must just sink at that moment, right?
I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. Melanie passed me. She'd asked me to go first. She knew I had the stronger team at that point. There's a dramatic moment when she turns around and comes back to me with her 14. I think she might have had 15 dogs. I had 13 at that point. We had these big, long string of dogs. And she talked to me, and she talked to my dogs. And then she did a big circle, which is very hard to do on the sea ice, because when we were nose to nose, our leaders were nose to nose when she talked to me and the dogs. She did a very talented circle, calling her dogs around so that she passed me from behind. I called up my dogs, and they would not go. So I returned to Koyak, and you know, I don't know if I should spoil the rest of the book. Clearly, I made it. That's on the book cover. But there were several moments of excitement between there and Nome.
Wow. Debbie Clark Modereau is with me for Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Her book is called Fast Into the Night. So this was all a decade ago, and now the book is here. And I'm wondering how you came to the decision to write about it, and what the experience was in terms of taking some of this very personal stuff and making it public.
Well, I have a problem with big goals. The joke in the family is, watch out, if she doesn't have a big goal, she's going to be grumpy. And so I know that about myself, and I can't really help myself. So as I neared the finish line, I knew I had lived an incredible story. I knew I was experiencing satisfaction that was really profound in a way that I couldn't quite pin down. So, and I definitely knew I wanted to write a story first and foremost to honor the musher-dog relationship that those of us that are lucky enough to participate in the Iditarod experience, because it's pretty unusual, and it's an incredible gift to have that chance. So I wanted to write about the dogs and my relationship with them, and I wanted to make more sense of the story. I never dreamt it would take me 11 years to get to this point. I thought it might be a 3-4 year project. About 5 years into it, I'd gotten a lot of encouragement from writing mentors at workshops, Kachemak Bay, writers workshop, places like that. But people had said to me, you know, it ought to be about this, or it's a family story. It's about Iditarod culture. And I thought, darn it, this is my story. I have to figure out what my story is about, and I need to learn to write better. So I went back to school and got a MFA in creative writing, which made all the difference.
Hmm. Tell me about that program. How did that work?
It's a program. There's one at UAA, a great program that was actually patterned a little bit after the one that I went to. It's just a little bit older than the UAA program. It's at Pacific Lutheran University, started by Stan Rubin and Judith Kitchen. You go to a 10-day residency every summer for 4 summers. There are many of these programs that have residencies summer and winter, and they're 2 years long. But, of course, I didn't want to go to school in the winter because it was going to upset my time with my dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So I lucked out. I looked for a program that went longer but only met in the summer in person. During the year, you work with a mentor for each full year that you turn in packets to on a regular basis. So I worked with 3 fabulous mentors and did both critical writing and continued to work on the book, which wasn't really the plan when I went there. I was just going to try to learn to write better, but everything I wrote had to do with this story. So,
So they would give you feedback and you would sort of learn, well, that maybe that wasn't the best way of saying that, and just develop your craft slowly.
I learned a lot about writing memoir, and I learned critical papers were due every packet, so I did a lot of reading of different writers, a lot of Alaskan writers, you know, Sherry Simpson, Seth Kantner, Nick Jantz. I read all these books while I was there and tried to figure out how I would tell my Alaskan story to as broad an audience as I possibly could. So I deliberately chose mentors that were not from Alaska to try to see how they would advise me. One of the mentors is a very urban woman. She lives in L.A., but I deliberately wanted to work with her and resisted working with the fabulous Alaskan faculty that work at Pacific Lutheran University in this program because I wanted to be challenged to write to the broadest possible audience, and I figured somebody from a city in the lower 48 might help me as well.
Well, the Alaska book buying public is minute, and you really can't be successful as a writer just on a book that's of interest only to people in Alaska unless you have a grant or something to do it. So that's part of the challenge is translating Alaska to people who don't know anything about it and doing it without getting into the cliches and the unreality that they bring to it from reality TV and from all the adventure movies they've seen and all that. Did you find that to be a special challenge?
I find it a challenge now in many interviews. I've done a host of Lower 48 interviews, and it's amazing what different parts of the country feel is the context in which I live and which it isn't. And so I find myself backtracking a lot.
Well, what are some of those expectations you run into?
Oh, it's just this epic of freezing temperatures and triumph and what an extreme sport. And time and again, I say, if I really felt like this was extreme, I would not have done it. You know, I wouldn't have taken my dogs into danger. And then I have to explain the relationship we have with wildness up here that we have to respect and that we're prepared. And that, you know, if we have to shut down for 2 days on the trail, we've got food to do that, you know.
But, you know, it's that mystique which makes them want to buy books and be interested in Alaska in the first place. So it's a double-edged sword. You want to be honest and you want to educate and tell the truth. On the other hand, you want to sell books and you want to get interest, and the sort of the mystique and the cliches give you that. And so I think it's an interesting tension that you have to work through.
It is an interesting tension, and the interest in Alaska is great for Alaskan writers. I mean, you know, everybody runs with their own advantages, and anybody writing right now about Alaska in the context of climate change or anything else that is represented up here sort of as a leading edge, I think it's important to get our stories out there, actually, and in a planet where wild places are becoming less and less accessible. You know, definitely I ran the race for the first and foremost for the love of the dogs and for the deep draw I feel to wild places. And we're pretty fortunate to live here and have these opportunities.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're still mushing. Are you still competing?
I'm still mushing. I'm not running Iditarod anymore. I could never have written the book if I still was. But we did go on the Serum Run. Our daughter ran the Serum Run, and so did I in 2007, which did help me flesh out some of the details in the book to see that course in daylight, not quite so sleep-deprived, was very helpful.
What about writing? Do you have other goals for other books you want to write?
I do. I think I'm a memoirist at heart, and I've got another book in me. I do want to write about my return to several wild places, part in Alaska and part not, in the context of other species and climate change.
Hmm. So just perceiving how things are changing from your personal...
Right.
Yeah.
For instance, I want to return to... a location on the East Coast and possibly one in the West where I went as a child and experience, I've already gone back to one of these places, experience mm-hmm. how they've changed or not. I'm very interested in writing about the bird migration. Some of the islands off the Atlantic are very different than they used to be. That's where I'm headed. I'm also part of a program at UAF on a science humanities collaboration working through microbial worlds, working through the microbiology department at UAF on studying change through visual arts and writing in conjunction with working in the lab with scientists.
Wow, that sounds interesting too.
I am not a scientist, so it's a challenge, but it's a new adventure.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. We've been hearing from Debbie Clark-Modereau. Her new book is called Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. It is available everywhere in hardback now. Thanks for being with me, Debbie.
Thank you, Charles. It's great to meet you and to be here.
And in the first half, we heard from Kayleen Sullivan-Johnson and Ray Bain. Kayleen's new book is about Ray and his really extraordinary adventures, also mushing and exploring Alaska. You'll find links to both of these books on our website at alaskapublic.org if you want to learn more or get one of the books. Thanks for being with us. Our producer and outdoor explorer is Eric Bork. Our production assistant is Grace Bogene. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.